You're listening to the Stoic Solutions Podcast, practical wisdom for everyday life inspired by the ancient tradition of Stoic philosophy from Greece and Rome. I'm your host, Justin Vakula. Visit my website at stoicsolutionspodcast.com. For today's episode, I recorded with author Donald Robertson about his new book, Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor. The book brings Marcus Aurelius to life for a new generation by exploring the emperor's fascinating psychological journey. Robertson examines Marcus's relationships with key figures such as his mother, the Emperor Hadrian, and Stoic tutors. He draws extensively on Marcus's own meditations and correspondence, and he examines the emperor's actions as detailed in the Augustan history and other ancient texts. Donald Robertson is a writer, cognitive behavioral psychotherapist, and trainer. He is one of the founding members of the Modern Stoicism nonprofit and the founder and president of the Plato's Academy Center nonprofit in Athens, Greece. Robertson is an expert on the relationship between modern evidence-based psychotherapy and classical Greek and Roman philosophy. He specializes in teaching evidence-based psychological skills. His work is highly interdisciplinary, combining philosophy, history, and psychology. On with today's episode. I'm here with Donald Robertson, author of the new book, Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
All right, a return guest on the podcast, so happy to have you back.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. It's good to be back.
Can you give listeners a quick elevator pitch for the new book?
That it's a prose biography of Marcus Aurelius that focuses more than previous biographies on the role that his philosophy played in relation to his life.
And how did you get the idea to write this type of book compared to your past books? This one was different than your previous.
The idea came to me because the publishing house asked me to write it. So that was easy. They asked me to write a biography, and I thought there already are biographies of Marcus Aurelius. I went away and had to think about it, and I thought, I like the other biographies of Marcus Aurelius, but I've always felt that they were lacking in that they didn't really say enough about Stoicism and how it influenced him. And I always felt a little bit disappointed by that. And I know that other people do too. Often people read Frank McLean's biography, which is probably the best-selling one, and it's a good biography. But Frank McLean actually is quite critical of Stoicism, quite negative about it. And I think that comes as a bit of a shock to people who are interested in Marcus Aurelius because of the meditations. So I wanted to write a biography that kind of filled that gap in the market, as it were.
Nice. And this is the Stoic Solutions podcast, so I think many listeners are familiar with Stoicism. But for those who are not, can you give a quick description of Stoic philosophy?
Stoicism is an ancient Greek philosophy. It was founded in 301 BC by Zeno of Citium at Athens, very much influenced by preceding schools of philosophy, including the ethical thought of Socrates in particular. It flourished for almost 500 years in the ancient world. And its last leading proponent of note is the Roman Emperor, Marcus Aurelius. And the central doctrine of Stoicism was summed up in the slogan, live according to nature, by which the Stoics meant fulfilling our potential as rational beings. And if we fulfill our potential to live rationally, then in effect, that means living wisely and in accord with the other virtues. So it's a virtue ethic. In fact, the Stoics think virtue is the only true good. And the main corollary of that is that if we genuinely believe that virtue is the only true good, then it means that things that people normally think are good, such as wealth and reputation, are less important to Stoics. And therefore, if Stoics lose those things, they're less perturbed by that fact. And for that reason, Stoicism, since its inception, has been associated with psychological or emotional resilience. And that's one of the reasons that psychotherapists are interested in Stoicism today, which is how I was first introduced to the subject, as it were, because I became interested in Stoicism because it was frequently quoted in books on cognitive psychotherapy.
And a lot of practical advice within the Stoic texts that endure today, that even though people were writing in the ancient world about their thoughts, it's very relevant to the human condition in 2024.
Yeah, I would say so. Cognitive behavioral therapy is the leading evidence-based form of modern psychotherapy. And I should say, like, you know, my background, my first degree is in philosophy. My master's degree is in the interdisciplinary study of philosophy and psychotherapy. And then I pursued a career for many years in psychotherapy in different modes, but particularly cognitive behavioral therapy. And so cognitive behavioral therapy is inspired by this doctrine in Stoicism that it's not things that upset us, but rather our opinions about them. And that really is the main, is the precursor of what we might call the cognitive theory of emotion. And now there are many, many research studies, hundreds of research studies demonstrating the effectiveness of cognitive behavioral therapy for a variety of emotional and behavioral problems. And so all of that arguably lends indirect support to the effectiveness of techniques and concepts found in ancient Stoicism as well.
Lots of benefits. And you wrote in your book that Marcus's training in philosophy could become his greatest asset by preparing him to endure challenges he would have to face as an emperor.
It seems to me that Marcus clearly turned to Stoicism and really became very deeply committed to lifelong, more or less, training in Stoicism. Something must have motivated him to do that. And I think there are two obvious explanations, three. One is that he lost his father at an unusually early age when he was about 4 years old, roughly. And it's clear that Marcus was looking, I think, for a substitute father figure, and he found several. But before he did, he was kind of taken under the wing of Hadrian, who I think frightened Marcus, because Marcus was afraid that he might end up like Hadrian. Marcus saw Hadrian at the end of his reign, when he was really a physical and psychological mess. He was suicidal, he was engaging in political purges, including against members of Marcus's own extended family. You know, so I think Marcus looked at Hadrian and he was shocked as a young man, as a teenager, and he thought, I really don't want to end up like that guy. And so he embraced Stoicism. I think the other thing that explains it was he was reluctantly, we're told, thrust into the succession. You know, he was destined to become emperor from that point onwards. And, you know, I think the responsibility that he felt on his shoulders was another reason that he was compelled to really embrace Stoicism, you know, as a whole system of life.
And it allowed him to be a virtuous emperor, not be vain, not be angry, not be like corrupt emperors that you wrote about in your book.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't many criticisms of Marcus Aurelius. He seems to be held up by subsequent generations of Romans as an example of a good emperor. And obviously that's the impression that we get from reading the Meditations and in the surviving histories of his reign. Also Antoninus Pius, his predecessor, is generally held up to be one of the best examples of a good Roman emperor. But Marcus wasn't perfect, and he's always emphasizing his own weaknesses to himself. And he doesn't state them very clearly from our perspective, but he implies that he has, for example, a problem managing his temper. Maybe at some point in his life, he felt that he was struggling with sexual desires. And we can see in the Meditations, we have to be careful reading too much into the themes in the book, because they reflect standard Stoic practices. Nevertheless, other Stoics such as Seneca talk about the desire for wealth and greed and not being mesmerized by gold. And Marcus basically never mentions this. He's much more preoccupied with how Stoicism can help him with interpersonal conflicts, with anger and frustration that he experiences towards other people around him who don't happen to share his values.
On the topic of wealth, you mentioned, you write in your book, that he had grown indifferent to the luxuries of palace life, that he could live like a private citizen despite being emperor without the need for decorative robes, statues, and other trappings of wealth and power.
Yeah, he seems to have been known for that. And Antoninus Pius was also known for that. There are many different types of Roman emperor. And some of them were flamboyant and modeled themselves on Eastern monarchs as they saw it. And they would dress in extravagant robes. about Marcus dressed down. I mean, it would be like the equivalent of a member of a royal family just, you know, wearing a suit and dressing, he would dress like a senator. Marcus appears to have had this reputation for wanting to appear, I think, more like a politician or a statesman rather than a monarch, if you like, and to distance himself from tyranny. But he also seems to have taken steps to share power, wanted to be seen to rule in a manner that was less autocratic than some of his predecessors.
On the topic of food, as you mentioned, he wrote that when you have a banquet before you, remember to tell yourself it is just a dead pig, a dead bird, and that the finest wine is merely grape juice and nothing more. By these and other means, you must learn to moderate your desires. So even being the emperor, he wasn't overly focused on food or giving food such prestige.
That may have been easy for him because he may have had a stomach ulcer problem. He seems to have had difficulties with his appetite. But he says other similar things as well. There's also an interesting passage in his letters with Fronto, where Fronto kind of jokes about how he saw one of Marcus's sons holding a lump of black bread, which, and he said, you know, he looked like a little philosopher, because philosophers are known for eating, you know, coarse, cheap bread. And kind of, it's another display of embracing poverty and living simply. But Marcus says that he inherited these values from his mother, who, Marcus's mother was one of the wealthiest women in Rome at the time, came from a senatorial family, patricians, and was extremely powerful and highly educated, very wealthy. But Marcus says that she was unlike other Roman elites in that she lived very simply and unpretentiously.
He also had the virtue of humility, as you write in your book. Marcus wrote, "I should no more be ashamed to receive assistance than a wounded soldier being helped up by his comrades."
He's often using things that he's seen in daily life, it seems, as metaphors for philosophy. And so it's interesting that he's writing this probably at Carnuntum or one of the other legionary fortresses on the Danube. So he's seen battle. Sometimes people question that, actually. You know, so some people might think, well, I bet the Roman emperor just stayed in his fortress and never really went anywhere near the front line. It's possible. Some did and some didn't. But actually, there's a clue in the Meditations that seems pretty authentic in its nature. He's talking in his private notes, and he's describing how people get alienated from the world, and he compares it to seeing severed heads and limbs on a battlefield in the aftermath of a battle. He says, you know that thing when you see somebody's body over there and their head is like several yards away, lying, and how that seems weird, like these two things should be connected, but they're at a distance. He says that's what it's like when people become alienated from the rest of mankind at a spiritual level. And you think, well, that's a really interesting metaphor, but it kind of implies that you've been walking around on battlefields and actually seen these severed limbs and heads lying around. So he clearly had witnessed at least the aftermath of battle firsthand, I think, based on the remarks that he makes. And so, you know, Marcus Aurelius is a guy who'd seen many things. He lived through or perhaps died as a result of the Antonine Plague. He lived an extraordinary life under a tremendous amount of pressure. And so the Meditations, I think many people are drawn to them because they see it as an example of somebody authentic who's genuinely put these Stoic principles into practice in an enormously challenging and dangerous situation.
It's a common theme in Stoic philosophy that people are called to take action, to get out there in the world, to try to make a difference, to try to find meaning, to try to take up challenges. And Marcus shows that in many stages of his life.
I mean, I really think that's how he saw it. You know, I believe that he would have rather been an intellectual, right? Maybe possibly a writer or a philosopher. He talks at one point, he seems to say that at one point he was planning to write a book about the history of famous Greeks and Romans that he abandoned. And I, if I remember rightly, he asks Fronto at one point for advice about how to write a history. So he may have wanted to be a historian or a philosopher. And we were told he was distraught when he was told that he was being adopted into the imperial family. And yet he embraced that role, I think because he saw it as his duty and it was his fate in a way to have been thrust into that position. So he thought, I wouldn't have chosen this for myself, but now that I've been put in this position, I feel that I have to make the best of it and be the best emperor that I can be, as it were. And, there are many individuals in that position who just exploit it and allow it to go to their heads. Marcus really seems to have been training himself to be a good emperor. He took his responsibility incredibly seriously.
It's a common theme within the ancient Stoic texts about taking on a role, trying to do the best you can with that. Mm-hmm. And it also recognizes the changing state of things, that we're not just going to stay in a corrupt empire or stay around difficult people, that we can make choices, that we could try to improve our situation. And sometimes walking away is that, sometimes trying to get involved in politics, as many of the Stoics did, and not just retreat and actively change things. It's a common criticism of Stoicism that, you should just put up with this or that, or be a doormat, to just accept whatever's thrown at you, but not the case.
I mean, the funny thing about that criticism is I don't really know. The Stoics were criticized for a number of things by other philosophers and thinkers in the ancient world, by the contemporaries. And some of those criticisms are similar to ones that are made today. I don't really recall any references, certainly not many references, to people in the ancient world criticizing the Stoics for being doormats or passive. Although you're right, people say that today. And I think that's because if you look at the lives of the Stoics, they generally are pretty active in politics and in the military, and they have a reputation for that. The Epicureans were known to some extent for withdrawing from society. I mean, that's exemplified in a way in the very foundation of the two schools. Epicurus taught his friends in a private walled garden outside of Athens. Zeno chose to found his school in the center of Athens in a public building where anyone could approach him, walking up and down the Stoapoikile facing the Agora, pretty much where Socrates used to do philosophy, on the streets out in public. And, so I think the image in the ancient world of the Stoics was that they were the opposite of kind of people who would retreat or withdraw from society. They thought we should engage with the world around us insofar as we're able to do so.
And Marcus also believed that humans were meant to work together, even in a state of war. He had thought that nature intended that, rather than people to fight, and it would be irrational to feel hatred or anger.
Yeah, in a sense, the Stoics, believe in the unity of all of mankind and nature. And you can see they conceptualize virtue and the goal of life, like in therapy, in a sense. All of these things, from one point of view, is about living in harmony and overcoming alienation. That would mean not retreating from the world. It would mean finding a way somehow to find your place in the universe and your place in society, and to feel a sense of connection, not just with the universe as a whole, but also specifically with mankind, even with, paradoxically, even with your enemies, people who are prima facie enemies. And Marcus says that very explicitly throughout the Meditations, but most notably at the beginning of book 2, and probably the most widely quoted passage from the Meditations in 2.1, he says, every morning when you wake up, tell yourself you'll meet people that are meddlesome and treasonous, deceitful, and so on. And then he says you have to remind yourself that they're your kin, not through blood or birth, but because you share a common humanity with them. And so this is him you know, saying, look, even horrible people, you know, there are good people and bad people in the world. There are people who are going to lie to you. There are people who are going to stab you in the back. Even those people are your brothers and sisters. You know, you're all in the same boat together, as it were, and you should focus on the fact that you're part of a larger cosmic community or cosmic city. You know, it's not obvious from the way that he phrases it. He doesn't say other Romans. He scarcely mentions Romans in the meditations. The people that he would meet people every morning. The emperor would have a formal meeting every morning. It was a Roman custom where he would receive envoys and receive clients. And, you know, he must be at some level referring to, at that time he's writing it, probably at Carnuntum. So it would be the many Germanic envoys, the tribal chieftains that he was at war with, or many of whom he was at war with at that time. So he's saying these Germanic people that you're literally in the middle of fighting a war against are your brothers. And that's a remarkable thing for him to be saying to himself.
And also, it's important to surround yourself with the best as a common theme within Stoicism, especially Seneca talking about friendship and what kind of people should you devote your time to. That time is this resource we're not going to get back. Life can end in a very fast manner, but many people might not make great choices about how they spend their time, who they spend their time with, how they value certain things, like we mentioned, maybe fame and wealth and other things people can overvalue, and they focus on those things, losing track of what might really be important.
Yeah, Marcus thinks that we should associate with people that we admire, so their good qualities might rub off on us. And but not only that, we should look for the good qualities even in the bad people. Like, for example, he praises Lucius Verus, his brother, her adoptive brother, at the beginning of the meditations. And he kind of damns him with faint praise. You know, he says he's loyal and affectionate. Well, you know, that's kind of like the bare minimum, surely. What would be the opposite? He's disloyal and, you know, unaffectionate. He's your adopted brother and co-emperor, right? So, I mean, that's the bare minimum requirement of a co-emperor that you've appointed is that they're at least not disloyal. And the bare minimum, I guess, of your adoptive brother who you've married to, or to your daughter, is that he's not hostile to you. He's at least a bit affectionate. So it's pretty faint praise, right? But nevertheless, he manages to come up with something positive to say. I mean, Marcus is a believer, and if you can't say something nice, then don't say anything at all, in a way. And that's a very glib way of putting it. For him, it's actually a contemplative practice with, you know, probably quite profound philosophical significance. He thinks we should search out the traces of virtue in other people in order to emulate them. I mean, it's for our own welfare. If we see nothing but vice everywhere we look, you know, you dye your mind with the color of its thoughts. You know, if you don't see anything good in other people, you're harming your own character, like by constantly feeding it these negative role models. So for our own benefit, we have to try and look for what's worth emulating in other people. And he does that systematically in book one of the meditations. Now, then there are people that he finds it easy to do that with. He describes the virtues of Antoninus Pius in such meticulous detail that it's pretty clear that he's done it before. And of course he had anyway. But later in the meditations, we can see that he does the same thing again and lists all the qualities that he admires in Antoninus Pius, his adoptive father and the emperor that preceded him. Marcus would have given speeches of praising Antoninus in the Senate. We know the Fronto refers to him doing this. So, you know, in a sense, it's part of his job to do this. But it's become a spiritual contemplative practice for him as well, to reflect on these qualities. And the person that, if we measure it very crudely, just by the word count, you know, having said that Lucius Verus, you know, doesn't get much, gets like, you know, a sentence, and Antoninus Pius gets his several paragraphs, the person that comes second is Junius Rusticus, Marcus's main Stoic mentor. So that's another indication how committed Marcus is to Stoicism, you know, that second only to Antoninus comes his Stoic mentor. He clearly has, you know, he has a whole list of things that he admires about this guy.
Right, finding the positive qualities in others, very important, taking an overall picture. But if people were to be disloyal, if people were not to be faithful as maybe advisors or friends or whoever in Marcus's life, then it's time to select new people instead of just continuing to do the same.
Yeah, as Marcus thinks it's important to associate with people that have a positive influence on him, but he also recognizes that we can't always do that. For instance, like if he's dealing with foreign envoys, he doesn't have that much control over who those guys are, and to some extent he needs to accept, I'm going to have to talk to that guy that's the head of the Chatai tribe again. He's a massive jerk. I don't believe a word he says, but I need to approach it philosophically. You know, it's my fate to be stuck in a room talking to this guy. Marcus says some funny things about things like that. He talks about, you know, having to deal with people that have bad breath and, you know, smelly body odor, even, you know, and learning to put up with that and adapt to it, you know, rather than complaining about it, and how to tactfully bring up the subject with them and so on. So, you know, Marcus had a lot to put up with. He had these wars to put up with. He had the plague to contend with. He had conspiring senators. But, I mean, I think he also mentions really trivial things as being a nuisance. Like, you know, he talks about people with body odor and the racket that horses make whinnying. Things like, you know, like these really mundane things that are actually pretty annoying if you, you know, perhaps if you're a writer. He talks about babies crying. I mean, I think anyone has children can sympathize. The sound of a baby crying is like a car alarm, you know, to a parent. You know, it kind of goes right through you. I imagine it'd be for someone who's a workaholic like Marcus and was up into the middle of the night, you know, answering letters and being meticulous. It's pretty hard to concentrate with sounds like that going on. I think he was like many people who are doing jobs that require meticulous attention. I get the impression he was irritated by intrusive noises at times. There are a lot of mundane. It's quite revealing in a way that even a Roman emperor gets frustrated with pretty mundane things.
I'm here with Donald Robertson, author of Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor. We'll move on to the topic of slavery, that Marcus, even in a time where slavery was common, slavery was accepted, he questioned the ethics of slavery, which was revolutionary for his time.
I mean, I'm sure there'll be some people that'll be shocked by that and would dispute it. So as always, when we're studying classics, we've got bits of evidence. So we have to do some interpretation. Marcus mentions in the Meditations that he only ever mentions the enemy by name once. And he says that people who take pride in capturing Sarmatians, one of the main races that he was at war against, people who take pride in capturing them as if they're capturing fish in a net and so on, have the character of a brigand. So it seems that he thinks people that take pride in capturing the enemy, he's referring to Roman generals capturing the enemy and auctioning them as slaves, I take it. If they have the character of a brigand, it sounds like he's suggesting that's unjust, that they're stealing something, they're thieves. And, you know, that's only a fleeting fragment, it's a tantalizing fragment. So we can't make that much from that in itself, except that it sounds like an argument that we find in other Stoic texts and in kind of Stoic adjacent texts that says that humans are naturally free and that to enslave people is to steal them from nature. And so the institution of slavery is inherently unjust. So we have in Diogenes Laertius a reference to this idea that the early Stoics reputedly said that slavery was wrong or unjust. You know, not just slavery in the kind of philosophical sense of being enslaved by our passions, but the actual institution of slavery itself. That would seem broadly consistent with things that the Stoics say. Now, I mean, often on the internet, where you get kind of hot takes on things, you'll find people saying, well, why didn't he just abolish slavery? Well, I mean, I would think that most people, if they think about it for more than 5 seconds, would probably arrive at the conclusion themselves that it would be tricky for a Roman emperor in the second century to abolish slavery overnight, because the Roman economy was based on it. And I mean, basically, being a Roman emperor isn't the kind of absolute power that many people assume it to be. Roman emperors got bumped off all the time. You can't just wake up one morning and say, hey guys, I've had this great idea. I'm going to pass a piece of legislation that just abolishes all slavery. I mean, you wouldn't make it past breakfast, right, as Roman emperor. Your life would be forfeit, right? I mean, you can't just do anything. Like, you'd probably get assassinated. And Marcus, as you mentioned earlier, faced a civil war. So it wasn't, you know, an abstract problem for him. He would have faced a war a lot earlier, a civil war, if he'd proposed abolishing slavery. And he actually says, therefore, in the Meditations at one point, you shouldn't wish for Plato's Republic overnight, or the Stoic Republic, presumably overnight. He says Plato's Republic for some reason. I guess he's just using it figuratively. It's probably kind of cliche at that point. It's like we say, ironically, we would say Rome wasn't built in a day. He's kind of saying Plato's Republic, you know, wouldn't be built in a day. And he says you should be satisfied in taking even small steps as long as they're moving in the right direction. So you could infer from that, he definitely sounds like politically he believes in gradual change rather than sudden revolution. That would be a fairly typical Roman idea, in the sense that Romans, definitely by this point, are terrified of civil war, would think that if you try to have sudden radical political changes, you run the risk of causing instability and civil war, and that's the thing they fear most. You could also say, well, is there any evidence that Marcus made gradual changes to Roman society that improved the condition of slaves? Well, yeah. Like, we actually have, there are several sources that we have for Marcus's life. I just want to mention very briefly, there are, talking of hot takes on the internet, I mean, I've met people online who will just are absolutely convinced that we don't know anything about Marcus Aurelius's life, which would be surprising because he was a famous Roman emperor. So, of course, we do know quite a lot. We know more about Marcus Aurelius than we do arguably about any other ancient philosopher, but certainly we know far more about him than we do about any Stoic philosophers. I mean, a lot of ancient philosophers, we have no idea what they looked like, right? We don't know what Epictetus looked like. We didn't know what Seneca looked like until relatively recently, when a bust was discovered with his name carved on it, and it turned out Seneca looks completely different from what people had previously assumed that he would look like. But we have many statues of Marcus Aurelius at different stages in his life, for instance. In addition to that, we have histories of his reign. We have a cache of his private letters. There are many inscriptions and coins and monuments. So we have all this evidence about Marcus Aurelius's life. But the least well-known source is that the Roman legal digests contain hundreds of references to pieces of legislation passed by Marcus. Now, often they're vague. And for instance, frustratingly, there are many references that say that someone obtained their freedom in accord with the ruling of the deified Marcus. But it doesn't tell us what that ruling was. But clearly there was some really important legal precedent that allowed people to be manumitted or freed from slavery, that it was created by Marcus Aurelius and attributed to him by subsequent generations. And there are, you know, scholars who have reviewed the legal digests and say the agenda that emerges from the rulings that we can see Marcus making is that he seems to want to improve the rights of children and women and slaves in particular. And he's making incremental changes that generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, may, you know, 95% of the time or whatever, make it easier for slaves to obtain their freedom under Roman law.
You also wrote in your book about his children, that about half of his children died. Yeah. How did this have an impact?
This is normal in Roman society, but, you know, it's still, it's pretty sure, I mean, it's not normal to have that many kids, but, you know, it's normal for the mortality rate to be that high, especially as they lived through a plague that would have killed many young children. It's hard to imagine today. In some ways, Marcus is just like us, right? Human nature, there are universal aspects to it. And the beautiful thing about the Meditations is that people can read it and they immediately find it relatable, like for the most part. But there are things that are a challenge, I think, for people to really imagine. One of them is, what would it be like to have that many kids? His wife was pregnant most of the time, with one kid after another. And to lose that many of, and also Marcus losing friends and family members because of war, plague, and so on. I mean, he was a man that by the end of his life had been bereaved many, many, many times. And, you know, that must have had an impact on his character. I mean, in the Meditations, we can see he's definitely preoccupied with death. And the Stoics are, in general. But, I mean, Marcus contemplates his own death more than, I would say, Epictetus or Seneca do. I think it reflects, you know, the character of somebody who, on the one hand, sees this as very important for his own spiritual development, and on the other hand, has perhaps been forced to come to terms with the loss of others many times. And you know, I think anyone that reads the Meditations feels that you come away from it feeling that Marcus Aurelius is a guy that had been through a lot and, you know, had seen a lot of people close to him dying. He seems like that kind of guy. I think as well that the Roman people must have viewed him in that way. And that added, I think, to the kind of gravity of his personality towards the end of his life. You know, people saw Marcus Aurelius as, in a way, a kind of survivor, but somebody who had been through a hell of a lot and been really tested by it.
You wrote that he was taught to neither be crushed by the present or fear the future. So this is an attitude not only applied towards death for Marcus, but everyday life.
You know, he's very concerned. Well, we said that he mentions often the minutiae of everyday life, you know, people with bad breath and things like that. He's very concerned with living in the here and now. He doesn't want to, you know, be lost in abstraction, because the Stoics, in a sense, worship nature. They worship existence, the logos. The here and now is like the face of God to them, in a way. And so it's important to be grounded in the present moment. It's a form of piety, in a way, to welcome and appreciate the present moment. It's what, you know, for them, God, Zeus, is giving us right now. You know, to turn away from it, in a sense, is to turn our back on nature and on God. So, I mean, that means that Marcus is a very grounded individual with an interest. You know, it's important to Marcus not only how he plans his succession and plans vast military campaigns, but also how he responds to somebody with bad breath. You know, in a sense, it's as important. You know, it's just another opportunity for him to exercise wisdom and virtue.
All right. As we're coming up on time here, a listener question is, was there something else you learned in your research that was surprising?
That was surprising. It's a little bit tricky to answer that question because I've been researching Marcus Aurelius for quite a long time. Most of the research that I did for this book, I did years ago. And so there weren't that many surprises that I had recently when I was actually writing that book, the Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor. There was I'll tell you an interesting piece of trivia. That I discovered, I went to Carnuntum for a week And there's a huge archaeological park there just outside Vienna. It's amazing. And I interviewed the CEO of the archaeological park and the director of archaeological research there. And I said to him, have you discovered anything in the ruins that directly relates to the life of Marcus Aurelius? Like a great deal of, there's always a question hanging over ancient literature. You know, this is a problem that classicists confront and historians, that, you know, often we're told things that from sources that are kind of seem unreliable. So, for instance, you know, a lot of the historical accounts that we have come from people like Roman senators who are clearly biased. I mean, it would be like, let's think of an example. It would be as if the only history that we had of contemporary America was written by Joe Biden or, you know, what's his name, Ron DeSantis or somebody like that, right? Like I said, you'd think it's going to be kind of biased, isn't it? Like, that would be weird. Like, the only history we've got is written by a politician, right? So, but Roman histories tend to be like that. And so scholars think, can we believe this? And also, some of our sources are satires. Like, you know, even for Marcus Aurelius's reign and the, in particular, the Parthian War, and also the Marcomannic War, like, some of the information that we depend upon comes from writings that are satirical. Like, so that would be like watching a satirical, I mean, I don't know, that'd be like watching SNL or Have I Got News For You or something like that, John Oliver, and, you know, using that to write history. You know, you think, but maybe, we can't tell, are they joking or are the jokes kind of grounded in fact? You know, are they exaggerations or distortions of fact? So there's always this question mark over written accounts, how reliable they really are. But occasionally, archaeologists will find something and dig something out of the ground that confirms something that's in writing. And that's, you know, shocking. It's exciting. So at Carnuntum, they found a funerary stone of a Praetorian soldier, Praetorian guard. And it was dated 171 AD. Now, the reason that that's important is it's fairly unlikely that a Praetorian would have died at Carnuntum unless the emperor was there at the time. It's the emperor's, these are the emperor's private army, his private cohorts, his personal guard. So that pretty much tells us that Marcus Aurelius was in Carnuntum in 171 AD. And that's important because the textual evidence implies that he was probably there writing the meditations around about that time. So the archaeological evidence lines up with what we can infer from the textual evidence. And I don't think, not many people perhaps know about that, but, you know, it was interesting to just be sitting speaking to the head of archaeology, and he said, yeah, we literally dug this thing out of the ground that proves the emperor was there in this specific year.
I found it interesting in your book that after a civil war, he had extreme forgiveness and had even pardoned some people.
I find that intriguing because let's dish some dirt on Marcus Aurelius then. There's a passage in the Historia Augusta that says that some people thought Marcus was less straightforward than he made himself out to be. And that always intrigued me. I thought, are they referring to something specific here? Like that he was pretending to be very straightforward and very moral, but it was perhaps more conniving behind the scenes than it seemed. And for a long time, I thought, I'm not sure. That seems like a vague remark. I'm not sure what specifically it refers to, but I think it may refer to the Civil War, because the account that we have of how the Civil War ended is kind of crazy and completely implausible. Often the sources hand down to his accounts that seem problematic. So, and it's seldom do people question this, but Avidius Cassius declares himself emperor or was declared emperor by his legions, I should say. And he effectively took control of most of the eastern region of the empire. And he was command of about 7 legions. So it was a serious threat. And then we're told that after about 3 months, 2 of his junior officers ambushed him and cut his head off. Now, that's not even the part that I find implausible. It's the next bit that's most problematic. So what did they do next? Well, I would have thought, normally, under the circumstances, the soldiers standing around, the Praetorian guards who would have been there, and Avidius Cassius's second in command would have had those men beheaded or burned alive as traitors, right? It's a suicide mission, normally, to walk up to an emperor and chop his head off. Like, you're not going to get out of there alive, right? But that's not what we're told happened. We're told that they stuck his head in a bag and waltzed out of Syria with it in order to present it to Marcus Aurelius. Now, it seems to me that the only way that that could conceivably happen is if all of the soldiers around them allowed them to do it. And it seems to me the only way that that would have happened is if Avidius Cassius' second in command said, let them go. And so that's quite puzzling. It looks, therefore, as if it was more of a coup and it had been planned by probably people of the senatorial class. And we're also told that his prefect in Alexandria was assassinated by the army around about the same time, right? Well, that's, you know, a bit of a coincidence. You know, again, that sounds like it was a coordinated attempt to overthrow Avidius Cassius's regime. And then the other part is that we're told that Marcus was heavily criticized for being too lenient on a guy called Druncianus, who was Avidius Cassius's son-in-law. And Marcus allowed him to retain most of his inheritance, and he actually took steps to protect this man against persecution. Now, that's kind of intriguing. We don't know this for certain, but one possible explanation for why Marcus might have wanted to do that is that maybe Druncianus, who was the son-in-law, and presumably also a general or held some kind of senior post in Avidius Cassius's regime, collaborated with Marcus and had some kind of role in ending the civil war. So we don't know that for certain, but it certainly, it looks like there's more going on here than just a couple of officers randomly decide to behead their emperor. So I think it's possible some people looked at that and thought, it may be that these guys plotted it and then hoped that Marcus would support them. Or it might be that Marcus had some role in planning this. He maybe approached people that were close to Avidius Cassius and said, you know, if you want to overthrow this guy, you know, and coordinate it, then I'll make sure that nothing happens to you afterwards and you get to retain most of your wealth. You know, you'll be looked after, sort of thing. So it may be that Marcus was kind of, but we don't know that for certain. But I think we should definitely ask that question, because that story is so fishy that for sure I think we at least have to wonder whether there's more going on there than meets the eye. But generally, Marcus was seen as living in a way that was pretty consistently in accord with his Stoic principles.
All right, very good. You'll find more stories in Donald Robertson's book, Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic Emperor. And where can people find the book online?
They can find it in any bookshops, or it's published by Yale University Press. It's an audiobook, hardback, and ebook. It's just came out today in the UK. It's already available in the US and in Canada. You can get it from any bookshop. And it's going to be translated into Portuguese in Europe and into Brazilian Portuguese for the Brazilian market. And there's probably other translations coming in the future as well.
And you're also the admin of the group Stoicism Group, Stoic Philosophy on Facebook. Now 115,000 members.
Well, there's a lot of people out there that are interested, but that's the tip of the Stoic iceberg. I'll give you another statistic from Facebook. Facebook says that there are over 1 million people who list the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius as one of their favorite books on their Facebook profile. Yeah, there's a lot of people out there that are interested in Stoicism. And, well, here's another, but here's some movie trivia for you. Gladiator 2 comes out this fall, allegedly, and it's the fictional story of Marcus Aurelius's grandson from the first movie, who's a fictional character. He happens to be called Lucius. So given that Gladiator 2 is about the grandson of Marcus Aurelius, it's possible there's going to be some more references to Marcus Aurelius in it. You know, like maybe just this guy who's now an adult in the movie, you know, remembering things that his grandfather said or did, you know. But I'm hopeful there might be some reference to Marcus Aurelius in that movie.
Yeah, a flashback scene or a time jump or time skip. We'll see.
At least some mention of him. There's more references to Stoicism in the first Gladiator movie, I think, than people realize onto the meditations. Russell Crowe is really into Stoicism. And the other movie that kind of came and went was the Seneca movie with John Malkovich, Seneca and the Creation of Earthquakes. I think I'm the only person that liked it. You know, everyone else seemed to really, you know, hate it. But I actually thought it was a really good portrayal of Seneca. That's pretty much what I imagine Seneca was like.
All right, very good. Other resources that you'd like to direct people to, where they can find you, more of your writings?
The main resource for Stoicism, in my view, is the Modern Stoicism nonprofit organization, which was set up by Christopher Gill. He's Professor Emeritus of Ancient Philosophy at Exeter University. And that was founded about 12 years ago now. And that organization, I was one of the founding members of it. And it runs Stoic Week every year. It runs the Stoicon Conference and Stoicon X conferences every year. It runs the Stoicism Today blog. And the current chair of it is John Sellers, who is also a highly regarded academic philosopher, who is the author of many books and articles on Stoicism. So the website for that is just modernstoicism.com. They might want to check that out. And I'm also the founder and president of a nonprofit based in Greece, where I'm going in a week's time to do some work on that, called the Plato's Academy Center. So people might want to Google that and check it out. Our goal is to build an international conference center near the original location of Plato's Academy in Athens. So those are some resources where, you know, there's lots of articles, lots of free events associated with both of those organizations and many, you know, best-selling authors, senior academics publishing their work there that people might want to check out.
And you have a Substack.
33,000 people that subscribe on it, and I post sometimes podcast episodes, but usually blog articles on Substack. And so, yeah, people can check that out. The URL for the Substack is donaldrobertson.substack.com.
All right, good. And social media, how can people find you on social media?
They can mainly find me on Facebook and Twitter, or whatever it's called now, X.
Like,
dumbest rebranding ever. Like,
yeah, Elon's just trolling everyone.
It's not even a verb. And they haven't
X gonna give it to you.
It's crazy. So yeah, that thing, and then and Facebook and stuff, I guess. They can find me on the easiest way to find me is just to go to my website, which is donaldrobertson.name, and they'll find links there to all my various social media accounts.
One more time, donaldrobertson.name?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Very good. Any closing thoughts?
There are many closing thoughts that I could mention, but one of them, I guess, the most important, I would say, is there are many, many important things I think it's useful for people to think about. But one of my main interests is in psychotherapy. And I very strongly believe that there's a great need in our society for people to address anger, and that many of the things masquerading online as self-help today actually make anger worse rather than better. And that, I think that's becoming increasingly self-evident. But the Stoics are one of our greatest resources for advice about coping with anger. Marcus talks extensively about systematic approaches for coping with anger, but and Seneca has an entire book on the psychotherapy of anger called On Anger. So I thought we'd encourage people to really look at what the Stoics say about anger and think about its relevance to modern life, particularly our online life.
All right. Very good. Thanks. Thanks for chatting today.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more content. The show notes contain more information and links about the topics discussed in this episode. Support my efforts through my Patreon page, found at StoicSolutionsPodcast.com. You can access special perks, including having upcoming podcast guests answer your questions, custom-made podcast episodes, and private one-on-one calls to discuss whatever you'd like. Visit my other podcast at hurdygurdytravel.com. That's HURDYGURDYtravel.com to learn how to make money, save money, and travel the world at low cost with credit card rewards, deals, and loyalty programs. Meet me in person during monthly meetings in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, with my group Greater Philadelphia Travel Credit Miles and Points, found at meetup.com/Philly Miles and Points. Thanks to generous patrons and fans of this podcast who help support my work. Have a great day.